right, so we are continuing on in our study of the Jewish foundations of the New Testament. So since we have some new folks here, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
We're glad to have you guys. So kind of where we're going overall is we are talking about what were the cultural, religious, historical underpinnings of the New Testament, right? Who was Jesus? Who was he speaking to in the first century? And we're trying to do three things so that we can become better stewards of the Bible. First of all, we're trying to keep in mind the idea, the priority, that meaning is about context. In order to understand the biblical text and then apply it to our lives, we have to first understand what it meant to the first century receptors of the biblical message. And we do that because, number two, we want to be good stewards of God's word. We want to submit ourselves to the word. And so in order to do that, we have to make sure that we don't add our own stuff into the meaning of the Bible, that we don't, you know, say, oh, well, obviously there's a car in the Bible or something crazy like that. So we want to submit ourselves to God's word. So we have, over the last few weeks, talked a little bit about some of the historical pieces of the what we call the intertestamental period. That's the period from after the Babylonian exile until the first century, when the Romans come in and we see the things happening reflected in the New Testament. Today we're moving into kind of a new section, and it's a section that I'm really excited about because we are going to talk about what is first century Judaism. When we read the Gospels, when we look at Jesus's conversations with the religious leaders, with the common everyday folk, with Gentiles, other people, what's going on in the world? What is Jesus reacting either against or with or in concert? What is that about? So over the next few weeks, we're actually going to take a look at what is first century Judaism, and we're going to break down some passages. Yes, we're going to get into the Word, and you guys are going to take a look at some different passages that we'll talk about in our class. Okay? So it was interesting because, you know, I sent out the email this week, and I was texting with James, and I said, you know, that email came out a little bit more passionately than I thought. So we'll see what you guys think. So as with our normal process, I have an introductory reading today from a Jewish piece of Jewish literature from the period that I'm pretty sure no one's ever heard of before. So actually we read another passage from this. It's called the Psalms of Solomon, right? And we read a passage either last week or the week before that talked about their desire for God to come in and basically throw all the Gentiles out of Judea. It talked about smashing them like pottery with an iron rod, and God's people basically taking over. All the nations would be subject to the people of the covenant, the Jewish people. So this comes from the same piece of literature, but it's a little bit different tone, shall we say. And this is what they say. It says, "And now you are God, and we are the people whom you have loved. Look and be compassionate, O God of Israel, for we are yours. And do not take away your mercy from us, lest they set upon us. For you chose the descendants of Abraham above all the nations. And you put your name upon us, Lord, and it will not cease forever. You made a covenant with our ancestors concerning us, and we hope in you when we turn our souls to you. May the mercy of the Lord be upon the house of Israel forever. So you see in this passage, they are acknowledging themselves as the covenant people. And it is something that God did first. God chose them. It's nothing that they have done. God chose them. And we're going to talk about that today, because today I am going to give you the definition of Judaism from the rabbis themselves. Not from our Christian ideas of what Judaism is, but from the words of the rabbis themselves. So I'm really excited about this because I think it might be a little bit different than what we commonly are taught in church.
Okay? Tom, what a modern day religious Jew read this type of literature on?
No, they would not. So maybe this. Let me just say, modern Judaism is very different than Hellenistic Judaism, which is, we'll define that, but it's the Judaism of the first century. Today, we often think that modern day Jews read the Old Testament the same way we do. That's not correct. Modern day Judaism is what we call rabbinic Judaism, which means that they look at the Old Testament they interpret it through the lens of the rabbinic sages and all of their commentaries, which was done basically after the first century. So we can't necessarily draw a parallel between modern day and other folks. So, but we'll talk a little bit about that. Okay. So last week's homework, I asked you guys to read Psalm 2. And it, of course, has some very interesting things in it. And the question was, if you were a Jew in first century Judea, and you had the Romans, you know, of course, who could make you, say, pick up their pack and carry it down the road for them, because, you know, I'm a Roman soldier and you're nobody, how would you react? Or what would you think or feel when you read Psalm 2? And you read things like, let us break the cords of their yoke, shake off their ropes from us. Right? So now, O kings, be prudent. Accept discipline, you rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord in awe. Tremble with fright. Pay homage in good faith, lest he be angered, and your way be doomed in the mere flash of his anger. What kind of reaction do you think a passage like this would have gotten from them? What do you think?
I just imagine a person who's like, you have no idea who I am, right? Like,
oh yeah.
Like, how dare you ask me to do stuff like this, or you have no idea the wrath of God that's going to come to you because of who I am and what God has promised my people.
Yeah. Yeah. Sort of like, don't mess with Clark Kent because he's really Superman.
Right. Yes.
Great thought. Any other thoughts? Oh, is it going to be a quiet day today?
So it's kind of interesting that what a picture this is, and of what they're dealing with, really. I mean, even though maybe it's two different time periods, you've got all of the leadership groups that are coming down on them, all the different countries that, so one day they're one thing, the next day they're the next, and then this does a really neat job of kind of painting a picture for it. I mean, like I say, it's two different time periods, but, of God sitting up in heaven just looking at the mess that they were dealing with, and their word is mocking. So, I mean, I just...
strong feelings, huh?
Yeah.
So, and I admit, mentioned this before, but the most, we believe that the most read piece of literature in the first century was the Book of Daniel. Because Daniel, of course, you know, presents the Jewish people in the apocalyptic sections as, hey, you're going to be rescued, right? You're going to be presented as God's people. You're going to be victorious, and all the other nations will crumble away. That's how they read it in the first century.
It's like a life of anxiousness, almost, just this constant knowing what's going to come, what hasn't, what could come at any time. Just, yeah. Pass from generation to generation.
Yeah.
It's kind of like what the Christians are thinking about the second coming.
Yeah.
Sure.
With expectations.
Yeah.
That's a really good point. So we won't get to it for several weeks, but we're going to talk about...
Oh, so this isn't the last episode.
Wait, was that a good or a bad? Okay. I wasn't sure.
I'm not done.
So, well, we're gonna talk about this expectation for God coming back and what that looked like in the first century and all the different ways that they talked about it. Because in Christianity in the first century, we had this figure, the Messiah, which we identified with Jesus, right? In Judaism, there were some folks that said, yeah, we think there's going to be a Messiah, but there's a whole cast of other characters. Actually, for the Essenes down in Qumran by the Dead Sea, they said, hey, there's going to be two Messiahs, two anointed ones. A priestly one and a military one who's going to lead us in the battle. So there was a wide variety of different sorts of viewpoints on it.
Hey, Tom.
Yeah.
One other thing about this chapter is toward the end of it. I thought it was interesting how it's kind of a warning. I mean, not kind of. It is a warning to the leadership of the time. That if you act together, that you need to remember who you're supposed to be serving. Mm-hmm. But then, I don't see it on that particular version, but in the version where I originally read it, it used the phrase "kiss the son," which I thought was interesting. I don't believe I've ever seen that anywhere else in the Bible. Maybe I haven't read the right stuff, but I know that they talk about like Judas with a kiss of betrayal, and but then the flip side of it, there's and I'm trying to remember who all of them, but there's like the kiss of friendship and
Paul greet each other with a holy kiss.
Yeah. And even in the Old Testaments, I'm trying to remember some of the examples there, but a friendship and that of honor. Mm-hmm. So, I just thought the whole thing was laid out in such a way that was really interesting when you kind of compare it against what we've been learning the last few weeks.
Yeah, definitely. Yes, I mean even today in the Middle East, greeting someone with a kiss is a sign of acceptance. It's a sign of honor. It's a sign of status. You know, you don't necessarily go to someone lower than you and kiss them, right? I mean, kiss the ring, right? That's a symbol of honor someone's giving to someone higher, at least in the Middle Ages. So that's a really good point. So again, part of this sort of milieu of understanding of what's going on in people's minds. Okay, so last week we talked, actually last several weeks, we talked about the successful rebellion against their Seleucid overlords. Now, what did their Seleucid overlords do? What did Antiochus Epiphanes say? He said, you can do whatever you want, Jewish people, right? Is that what he said?
So, I don't remember any of the leaders saying that.
Yeah, no, he didn't. In
not
fact,
anything Jewish.
yeah, you can't do anything Jewish. He said, you're not going to be Jewish anymore. In fact, I'm going to go into your temple, and I'm going to sacrifice a pig on the altar. And that created this rebellion. So, was the rebellion successful? Bueller?
Yeah.
Yes, it was. So, they create this new Jewish dynasty, the Hasmonean dynasty, but they end up looking just like the old rulers and doing stuff like attacking the Gentiles, forcing them to convert to Judaism. Not really the idealized version of David and Solomon, right? And then here come the Romans. Romans say, no. We're going to show you guys how to really run a kingdom. And they take over. And they put this guy, Herod, in charge. And it really kind of enhanced this conflict between the idealism of the monarchy, David and Solomon, and the greatness of their kingdom versus, really? Herod's our king, the king of the Jews? He's not really even a Jew. He's really from Idumea, one of the forced converts to Judaism. But he made a great temple, you know? So, and we talked about how these political changes created multiple issues in the first century. People were, the rulers were coming in, giving away people's land. They couldn't survive, so they turned into bandits to feed their families, things like that. So, right, so that's last week. So where are we going? Today we're going to talk about Judaism. We're going to talk about the major beliefs, and we might get a little bit into how did the changing political and cultural climate affect their identity. That's really important because Hellenistic Judaism is reacting against this thing called Hellenism. We'll define that. So in our next few weeks, we're going to talk about what did Judaism look like in the first century? How did someone know you were Jewish? Right? And then we'll talk about the New Testament. And we'll look at some different ways we can use to study the New Testament, to get more out of the New Testament than just reading it and saying, well, what does that mean to me?
So correct me. I'm just trying to picture everything in my head. This is the time when Christ was around and everything that was going on with when he was growing up and doing his ministry.
Exactly.
And then even after that with all the disciples doing mm-hmm. their thing and Paul doing his thing.
Yeah.
This is everything else surrounding it.
Exactly. So here's how I would term it. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to talk about Judaism, right? Kind of as a whole. Then we're going to talk about, like, the individual pieces. What did the Pharisees think? Right? They had some differences from other folks. What did the Sadducees, the religious rulers, what did they think? We're also going to talk about these crazy Essenes who said, no. You guys are all wrong, and to prove you're wrong, we're going to go live out in the desert and be the real community of God. Because you're all heretics.
Which is Qumran,
yeah. Yeah, down by the Dead Sea. So we'll talk about overall, we'll talk about what links these three, but we'll also talk about specifics. Because if you notice in the Gospels, you know, the Gospel writers will say, hey, there were the Pharisees, a group of scribes. Who were the scribes? Talk about the Sadducees. These are all different groups. So when we read the New Testament and read the Gospels, we need to be able to differentiate that they all had different concerns. And that way we can better understand what the gospel writers are actually saying to us.
So were the guys that were not the Pharisees or Sadducees, were those zealots?
Zealots are another party, yes. Probably not going to talk as much about them, maybe just a little bit, but, you know. Yeah, there's probably maybe 12 different groups we could talk about, but you know, I figured lecturing, I'd probably bore you guys enough. So, you know, we can talk about the Sicarii. Those are the guys who said, we hate Romans so much that when we're in the marketplace walking by a Roman soldier, we're going to slip a knife into their back and kill them.
Wow.
Yeah, didn't like them so much. So, all right, so let's talk a little bit about questions to answer. What questions do you guys have, things you want to make sure we cover? Because like I said, as much as I love to hear myself talk, I'd rather actually answer your guys' questions. So what questions do you have about Judaism that we need to make sure we answer? This is the point where y'all talk.
I think there's probably just some core beliefs and kind of cultural ideals that influence those beliefs that was happening at this time, and trying to understand the difference between that time and today. Like,
okay.
What's changed between now and then, and how they believe and how they look at things, or is it really that much different? And because I guess if I'm talking to a modern day Jew about their history and trying to understand, like, what they believe today versus what was going on during the time of Jesus, I guess it just kind of helps me connect the dots a little bit. So
okay, we can definitely do some of that.
With Jesus' crucifixion, what about a little bit of information about the Sanhedrin?
Okay, who are the Sanhedrin? In the Greek, they talk about the boulos. That's the Greek word for the gathering. So who is it? Who are these folks? Is this boulos, the Sanhedrin? What else?
So Tom, I just find it fascinating that, and I guess you could say the same thing about our culture now, but I mean, they're living in it. They're seeing it. You could almost argue to some degree that today it's not happening right in front of them. But
we say them. Who are you speaking of?
The people around it, the people of Jerusalem, neighboring, really. I mean, the whole Israel. But, I mean, if you think about it, this is happening right in front of all the different things, all the miracles that Jesus is doing. It's happening right in front of them. So
why didn't they recognize who Jesus was?
Yeah, it's, and, the funny part about this is, so if... if you would have asked us, whatever, 5 or 6 weeks ago, what questions were, we'd probably be just as stumped with giving you some, just because I had no clue what to ask. But
okay, all right.
You're filling in so much and giving us, kind of painting a picture of everything up to this point. So keep painting.
Fair enough. Okay, we will keep painting then. All right, so we talked a little bit about changes with Judaism and such. So I put together this one little handy-dandy flowchart based on a conversation Tom Gaze and I had. I'm not going to – this will be on the PowerPoint, so you guys can go and download it off of my blog if you want. But I just want you to notice, the timeline and the major periods of Judaism. So we have the Exodus in the 13th century, and then we call this the Hebraic period, up until the extent, basically the monarchy is founded and the first temple, Solomon's temple, is built. So we call, once the temple is built by Solomon, we call that first temple Judaism. And that runs until the Babylonians come in and destroy the temple, 587. Right now they come back, and Zerubbabel, 70 years later, creates a second temple. So that begins what we call the second temple period, and that runs all the way up until the Romans destroy the temple in 70 CE, which, as you might imagine, is a very big deal in Judaism. Because at that point, past then, you don't have priests, you don't have sacrifices being done at the temple, all these sorts of things. So we see major radical changes during the next 100 years or so. Also, you have these rabbinic periods that stretch back into the intertestamental period. So once these were put together, or these were named much later, but it's people looking back and saying, this is what we're going to call these different periods of the rabbis.
Okay. Are these names of rabbis?
No, actually, they're just names for the periods. And actually, that just caused me to remember, I was actually going to give you guys a copy of all the different rabbis that we have and such from that period. So I'll have to do it next week, but I apologize. But so the point is this. We often present Judaism in our own minds as sort of this monolithic religion. Everything's always the same. And that's not true. I mean, I think we know that's not true of Christianity, right? We had something called the Protestant Reformation 500 years ago that radically changed Christianity. Those same sort of forces are at work in Judaism as well. So, all right. So which Judaism? Why am I saying which Judaism? Because our modern popularized view of Judaism comes from Martin Luther. Believe it or not, he was a smart guy. But he did something that really wasn't that great. He kind of threw Judaism into the same bucket as Roman Catholicism. He said, hey, those Roman Catholics, they're doing salvation by works. You got to get these indulgences and all this sort of stuff. And he threw Judaism into the same bucket and said, oh, they're all about, you know, earning their way to heaven. Well, the legacy of that picture hasn't been for most of us in the Christian church. We read the conflict between Jesus and the leaders as one of empty ritual on their side versus faith, right? Jesus is all about faith. We agree with Jesus. So if you ask most people today in the church, they'll tell you Judaism is about legalism. It's about earning their way to heaven. The reason they do sacrifices and all these sorts of things is because they believed you had to do these things in order to get saved, to use a Baptist term, right?
Which I've read that Jews, what we kind of in our minds think of as sinning is not really how they view it, that it's kind of more of a, like, missing the mark or not. Is that a fair statement?
We'll talk about that, because there is definitely a difference in terms of how we view what we call in theology original sin. Which is, do you have a sin nature?
Right.
There are definitely some differences there. And we'll actually have, the rabbis will speak to this. So that's kind of the popularized view.
I
go ahead.
I have a question for you. This is going to sound weird.
That's
nowadays,
okay.
Nowadays you have Jews that are, how to say it nicely, practicing Jews, mm-hmm. and those that are just cultural Jews.
Okay.
Back in the first century, did you have those Jews, was everybody a practicing Jew, or were they half cultural, half, you know, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, sure. No, that's a great question, and we're going to talk about that. I say that a lot, don't I? Sorry. Yes, you had a lot of different people making different choices about what does it mean to be Jewish in the Greek Hellenistic context. So you had some folks who said, no, I like the fact that here in Alexandria, Egypt, I can become a citizen and have a really cushy job with the government. And, you know, all I have to do is basically not circumcise my kids. And they said, I'm okay with that, so I'm going to do that. So the question was, they're ethnically Jewish. where's that line? You had other people, such as a group we'll talk about called the Therapeutai, who said, no, no, in order to be Jewish, you have to get rid of anything that sounds like it's Greek. You can't speak the Greek language, you can't do this, you can't do that, and we're going to live off over here in Egypt by ourselves. That's what it means to be Jewish. So the short answer is you had a lot of different sorts of things. And actually, I've got a little graph to kind of see if it can put it together in your mind, I guess. So, but that's in a few weeks or so, whenever we get done. Now, so my background, just so you guys know, is theology.
Shocker.
Yeah. So, in theology, we have not done you guys, the church, any favors on this subject. Because for a long time, many, many centuries, we downplayed the Jewishness of the New Testament. Literally downplayed it, ignored it, and said, no, no, that stuff doesn't matter. You don't need to pay attention to that. And we did that because we said, well, you know, it's this. We wanted to talk about the Greek background, the Roman cultural background. This Jewish stuff, no, we don't want to talk about that. So there was this idea that Paul's letters reflect his Greek background, right? Not his Jewish ancestry. I mean, here you have Paul, who is the Pharisee of Pharisees, is how he talks about himself. But yet scholars said, no, he's, you know, don't take that seriously. You know, just read him like you would a Greek historian. Read him like you would Tacitus or something like that. Ignore it. Okay, well, that's, we look back on it now and that doesn't make much sense, obviously. So we had that going on. Well, we also had this idea that the Jesus of the Gospels is a creation by the later Greek church, Christian church. So you can't trust, you know, any of the Jewish stuff that you see in the Gospels. We had, for example, this guy, Vrede. He came up with this idea called the Messianic Secret. Okay? And the Messianic Secret was that the disciples didn't really know that Jesus was the Messiah until he was resurrected. Or he would probably say until they believed he was resurrected. So they went back and wrote it back into the Gospels. Jesus never actually said he was Messiah, but this is them, you know, trying to explain his resurrection. So you can't, you know, it's the later Christian church that's saying this stuff about Jesus. So you can't trust that the stories in the Gospels actually reflect, you know, what actually happened. Right? See how that works? You know, kind of cuckoo, a little crazy.
So to your other point, does the Hellenistic viewpoint influence the King James Version that we all read as to how it was translated, and would things maybe have had a different tone through a Jewish lens in the New Testament?
Probably not, actually, because the translation issue, we'll talk a little bit about that. I'll say this, the King James has some issues with translation, and we'll talk about that. But for the most part, these ideas are happening after the King James was written. So it didn't really have that much of an impact on it. That's how old the King James is. You know, it's over 400 years old now. So this is stuff that's happening in like 18th century, 19th century, 20th century theology. So, but what we see is, to quote the famous theologian and doctor Albert Schweitzer, he said, and I'm paraphrasing him here, he said, these theologians, they looked down into the well of history to find Jesus, and they saw their own reflection. And that's the Jesus they came up with. And that's always a danger for all of us. you know, when we approach and start talking about who Jesus is. So that's why we need to study, right? The context and understand what's going on. So we don't see ourselves and think it's Jesus looking up at us. So we didn't do you guys any favors. And this whole deal is my attempt to apologize.
Thanks a lot, jerk.
Yeah, you're welcome. So let me give you an example, specifically. Okay, Martin Luther, great guy, a giant in terms of theology, obviously. But on this point, yeah, not so much. So if you understand Luther, you have to understand this idea of works versus faith, or law versus grace. He put everything into, this is the way he saw everything. It's works versus faith, law versus grace. So everything went into one of these two categories. And for him, he said, well, obviously, Jesus and Paul, they go into the grace. They go into the faith bucket, right? Make sense? Well, his opponents, the Roman Catholics, he said, no, those are the works people. Those are the law people. They're trying to become Christians or become saved by doing all this stuff. So then he went, aha, well, Jesus and Paul, they had opponents, and they were Jews. So, obviously, Judaism is the opposite of what Jesus was talking about. So, therefore, Judaism is all about a salvation of works. It's about the law. It's about legalism. And that's pretty much where it started, as crazy as it sounds. Now, there were other things going on, too. He had some other influences. Luther, for all the great stuff he did, was pretty much a virulent anti-Semite. I mean, I don't know any other way to say it. Some of the stuff that he wrote later in life about the Jews, it is, wow. It is crazy. And so there's actually today in white supremacy, they will put their political views in a Christian sort of context, and they'll appeal a lot to Luther and stuff to do that, just so you know. Kind of the same way that like ISIS puts their political views in the context of Islam, that's what white supremacy does with Christianity. Now, there were other things as well besides Luther. We don't want to dump too much on Luther, right? I mean, But there was some intellectual laziness. I'm sorry, scholars were intellectually lazy. They did not actually read the Jewish literature. And then they'd write these big books on it, and they wouldn't actually read it. It's crazy. And then there was also this idea that of the superiority of Christianity. You know, there was, during this time period, folks were talking about evolution, and there was this idea that all these other religions evolved into Christianity. So Judaism is just a precursor. You know, it's a religion that didn't quite get there, but thank goodness Christianity did. So it's sort of religiously inferior to Christianity.
It doesn't make any sense, because Judaism was the foundation through Abraham. I mean, I don't know how to say it, but
yeah,
that's where it started. Now, you know, it was the original covenant with God, and God brought out what he said he was going to do, and now these people are out.
You know, yeah, they would agree with you. Yeah, it started there, and then it evolved. But, you know, they were like, it's this whole mindset of looking at something. Mm-hmm. You know, we're doing the coexist class at 11 in here, you know, and we're talking about these mindsets of how we can completely miss the point, you know, by giving in to our own presuppositions. And that's what they did. So I am going to dump on Rudolf Bultmann, who is the biggest theologian, New Testament theologian of the 20th century. I mean, if you're talking about giants in terms of theology for the last 500 years since Luther, he's up there with them. I mean, he's up there with Barth and all those other guys. Now, that being said, I can almost completely disagree with everything he said. But he's still a giant. I mean, the intellectual powerhouse is amazing. So he took all this stuff and talked about, in his book, Primitive Christianity. Again, see that evolution idea? Here's what he said about Judaism. And this, because he was so smart and so important, became the template for how people saw Judaism. He said, of ethics, meaning what, why you do the things you do, and ritual, what you do, ritual for Judaism is the more important of the two. It's about what you do, not what they believe. He said the obedience to the law was formal, not radical. They cared about doing the things more than they did about the spirit. The accumulation of merits might atone for breaking Torah. This idea that you would do these things, accumulate merits, and if you had more merits than you did bad things, then you would get to go to heaven. He says, we find the righteous proud and self-conscious, meaning the religious leaders, they were proud, you know, were self-conscious. They didn't, you know, they didn't really understand stuff. He said, repentance itself became a good work, which secured merit and grace in the sight of God. And in the end, the whole range of man's relation with God came to be thought of in terms of merit. Your relationship to God was based on what you do, not the covenant.
So he's a non-Jew interpreting Judaism for us.
Yes, he is a German scholar who is...
who is the expert on Judaism.
He thought he was.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
He thought he was.
Interesting.
He was definitely an expert on different things. He's a really interesting guy. You may have heard of something called existentialism, this idea that we learn truth through experience. He's the guy who combined existentialism of like Kierkegaard and such with New Testament scholarship.
So, Tom.
Yeah.
Forgive the ignorance of this question.
That's okay.
This is his interpretation of Judaism.
Yes.
And if I had to list my interpretation, it would probably be fairly similar. That it's works based. Judaism now versus, I think it was different back before Christ.
Yeah.
But. I think Pharisees are my picture in my head anyway is that they're proud and self-conscious.
Yeah.
Really down the whole list, I guess, and maybe I'm misguided like him, but
and that's where we have as theologians have failed you. We've led you down a path that because Bultmann didn't read hardly any of the rabbis before he wrote this stuff.
So this is completely misguided.
I will let you decide for yourself because we're going to see what the rabbis actually say. How's that?
Okay.
I'm not going to tell you what to think, but I will show you what the rabbis say about themselves.
But some of what shapes our viewpoint to say that, yeah, I get some of this is just from what we read in the New Testament, though. So...
That's a good question. So let's take a look at a passage. Let's break up into groups of maybe four or five, something like that. And let's read this passage, and we'll talk about these questions. Sound good? All right, go ahead. I'm going to run out and get a glass of water.
All right. Okay.
Yes.
expect any less.
And no, with these two? I've heard stories. Did you know him back then?
We met.
Unless you nullify the word of God, this is the tradition. You hypocrites, Isaiah, prophesied about you.
No.
These people honor the Lord, but their hearts are far from me.
Okay.
They worship the Lord, but their hearts are far from me.
All right. Are we going to read this?
This is called the crowd.
All right. Some Pharisees and teachers of court, religious law, now arrived from Jerusalem to see Jesus. They ask him, why do your disciples disobey our ancient tradition? They ignore our tradition for ceremonies. Jesus replied, why do you by your traditions violate the tradition of God? For instance, God says, honor your father and mother. Any mother who speaks disrespect to her father and mother is subject to death. But you say it's all right that whatever happens to your parents is starting to get healthy. For I have found that you have not been honored with the parents. In this way, you say they don't need to honor
out of the heart
your parents. And so you can insult your God and you say that your whole tradition is hypocrites. Isaiah replied,
so, what are they asking?
Jesus called the crowd to question the disciples and try to understand.
Like why? Almost like why do you give them disrespect? These traditions that we have,
Then the disciples,
that is tradition.
Yes, there's this one. What they asked in the Pharisees, like what we just said. Jesus
give about 2 more minutes. We'll come back together and discuss.
Check.
But again,
he's taking what their thoughts are and verbalizing them.
Pretty much.
Okay. Why don't we come back together and kind of see. Now, let me say, first of all, there aren't any surprises. I'm not trying to pull the rug out from under you guys or anything like that. So, well, let's talk about your guys' thoughts about this passage. So, what was the passage about?
Washing hands.
Washing hands. Yeah?
We should get
hand sanitizer.
It's amazing. It's like they knew about the flu back then. Yeah.
I see it as just religious leaders trying to trip up Jesus, and because of their traditions and their
religious leaders.
Yes. They seem proud and self-conscious.
All right, yeah, they do.
John was like, check.
He's like,
what are you trying to teach us here, Tom?
Yeah. I don't get it. Okay, what other thoughts? So they're asking about hand washing. What is their motivation behind asking?
Trick him or trap him.
Trick him or trap him? Okay, well, tell
discredit
me.
Discredit the disciples.
Well, there's
okay.
So many laws that came, you know, the ceremonial things that they did, being unclean and then becoming clean, and the sacrifice, you know, all that law that they started to implement and just add more and more and more and more that really wasn't necessary. Jesus is saying, so are you telling me that
it's almost
yeah.
like that, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I think for so long, I mean, they've had this laws, and that for a long time, they followed these laws. This one guy comes in, shakes things up, I think, and it's a natural response to be like, what have we learned this whole thing? Like, what's the point of what we've been learning for, you know, all this time? If, like, you know, I think that would be our natural response, too, would be to, like, okay, you know, when someone comes along in Christianity or whatever and tries to throw a wrench in something, it's a natural response to say, well, let me catch you.
Yeah.
Right.
Because this is what we've learned. Are you telling us that it's just been lies?
Right.
You know, it makes them feel stupid. For like,
well,
I've been learning this all, you know?
They were comfortable with all these laws.
Yeah.
I mean, this is what kind of defined them. They knew what they were supposed to be doing based upon all these laws.
One person in a few years...
So what's the following story about? Did you take a peek at that?
Mm-hmm.
What's that a following story about?
It seems like a contrast where Jesus is saying, well, you know, because you're talking about a condition of the heart, and it's about, you know, in the prior stories, like, it's about where your heart is, right? It's not about your lip service. It's about your heart.
Mm-hmm.
And there, it almost seems like he's like, well, here's this woman who is asking for mercy. Her heart's in the right place. But I'm not here for you. I'm here for these people over here because tradition says that I didn't come for them.
Yeah. You're a Gentile.
Yeah.
The word of God is not to you.
Yeah.
It's an interesting contrast, isn't it?
Yeah.
So my point in having you talk about this is not to, I think you all had really great thoughts. My point in discussing it is not to overthrow it or anything like that. It's a marker. So we'll come back to this after we do the rest of our study and kind of see what you guys think and see if maybe there's been some changes in what you think. Maybe there hasn't. I don't know. We'll see where we end up. So... But I did promise everyone I would end at 15 till, and we're right there. So before I forget, let me go to our homework for next week. And let me preview by saying this view that we're talking about of Judaism about legalism. 1977, this book came out. E.P. Sanders. I was 4 years old, and I did not understand the important things that had happened with this book coming out. And this book changed our view of the first century world in Judaism. I mean, there's no other way to say it. This book changed. And that's why this is a 40th anniversary edition. Very few books get a 40th anniversary edition.
You say it was a correction to a lot of the ideals that Rudolph brought to the table.
Yes. Because E.P. Sanders, who wrote this book, actually read the various rabbis and took a look at what they said to understand what really drove Hellenistic Judaism. So we'll start there next week. And your assignment for next week, as soon as we get this, is to read Galatians 2, verses 11 through 21, and think about these questions. What does Paul admonish Peter for in front of the church in Antioch? And what is the effect of following the law, quote unquote, the law, according to Paul? Now, I guess you need to think about what is, quote unquote, the law for Paul. Okay? Now, so just normally like we do, I will send out the PowerPoint for today. I will post on theologicalstraydogs.com. the audio, so if you want to revisit, we can do that. And next week, we'll see what the rabbis actually have to say on their own behalf.
And you're bringing a rabbi with you.
No, but in light of was interesting, because next week I'm actually teaching on postmodernism in the 11 o'clock class, so maybe I should show up as a postmodern rabbi? I don't know what that looks like, but I don't know. But I thank you, everyone, for being here. Thank you so much for joining us. A little bit different, I'm sure. Let's end in prayer real quick. Lord, thank you so much that you are a God who speaks to us, that you are a God who is with us throughout the week. Help us to share your message with others we run into this week, others that are in our lives. Help us to understand who you are, so that we can better share with others. Watch over everyone who's not here and all the different prayer concerns. In your name we pray. Amen. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
It's nice to meet you.